You ready?
This is the Mike Salk Show
on Seattle Sports Station.
Are you ready?
Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studio.
Streaming through the Seattle Sports app and at seattlesports.com.
Are you ready for a good game?
Well, it was a good time right at the end last night as the Mariners found a way to come back. Abraham Toro, big home run to tie it, and then Ty France walking it off in the bottom of the 10th, and man, did they ever need it. Mike Salk Show here this hour, driven by Wastecarf Ford. So what was the best, what was the most meaningful part of this weekend? I think I could point to three moments that could qualify for the number one and five that are worth talking about in general, and all of them hopefully mean something towards the rest of this season. So let's start here with George Kirby. If it's real, if what you saw yesterday, if it's real, it's spectacular. If it's real, it could stabilize this team, stabilize the rotation. And obviously it means you've got a potential long-term ace, just like he was predicted to be, yeah. Right? I mean, top 15 prospect this year. If it's real, it really is spectacular. So a few things that jump out to me about him. One, he's throwing 98, which is obviously not normal, right? Dude just calmly and casually looks like he's playing catch, but the ball explodes out of his hand and he ends up throwing an easy 98, and he's got a ton of run on it. So, I mean, we're just talking about this with Brock. He asked about Mark Pryor, and I think Pryor's a really good comp for the weight, you know, just how easy he throws. Mark Pryor was ridiculous. I mean, he was high upper 90s, just looked like he was playing catch. Had those giant calves. I mean, he wasn't built at all like Kirby, but just so easy and fluid. The fact that Mark Pryor ended up blowing out his arm and getting hurt is A, shocking, and B, a real question mark on Dusty Baker's resume, because there's just no way a guy who threw that free and easy should ever get hurt like that, but whatever. Anyway,
shocking.
Watching Kirby, he's got all of the ease of a Mark Pryor, but with this crazy run. So arm side run means as he's throwing it, he's a right-hander, the ball's tailing back to the right side, right? To his arm side. So, I mean, generally it takes a two-seamer to do that. When you throw a two-seamer, right, you're going to throw it not quite as hard as you would throw a four-seam fastball, which are generally fairly straight. His natural arm movement just causes the ball to drift back that way. And you saw a swing and a miss. I want to say, was it a Rosarena? I forget who it was, who swung right through it because the ball took an abrupt right turn at 98 miles an hour and ends up sliding outside the zone, and good luck. So that was really great. I mean, just watching his stuff. He pitched in a really interesting way. I thought he used his slider when he got in trouble. Like, he got behind a few hitters, right? 2-0, 3-0, 3-1, et cetera. And he used his slider more to get it over, right? More for strikes, and then ended up getting most of his swings and misses on the fastball. So not something you see very often. But the last thing you got to point out, his presence. So calm. I mean, like, almost preternaturally calm. And I think what's interesting to me is, and this was a Rosarena, when he took off from first base, when he kind of had him picked off.
Step off the mound.
To end the sixth. Presence of mind, stay calm, stay collected. Rookie making his first start. Game can speed up on those guys in a hurry. And instead, calmly steps off the bag, runs right at him, starts the rundown, did everything right, and that's how he ends up going six shutout innings. So I thought it was really cool. It was great seeing his fan base, his friends and everybody, his college friends and high school friends, Little League friends that were all there and around him. But what a remarkable start for Kirby.
I was showing the video of him running out of the dugout to the mound and the camera, the steady camera that follows him and does a kind of circle around him. When he gets there, the music's playing and he signs an autograph for Little League Day at the mound. It's like, what an unbelievable moment. And I showed it to Betsy last night. She goes, could you imagine how nervous you'd be? I was like, yes and no. Like, you know what it is. You know what the moment is. You know what's coming. But the second you step on to a comfortable place, the mound, and you go through your little routine, you scratch in the dirt the same way, you dust your cleats off, whatever it is you do, you have to believe that somebody can find their comfortable spot in the most uncomfortable position. And he clearly did. I mean, threw a lot of strikes. And he obviously having his own little cheering section there probably didn't hurt. You know, like, you have some of your, like, your built-in sense of comfort boys, the guys that you've played with for most of your career.
It was awesome, man. It was a treat to watch him, watch him pitch, and it kind of excited. I got a 206 saying, is he like Tim Hudson at 98? Maybe. When I think of Tim Hudson, I think of more sink than he's got. I mean, it looks like a two-seamer, and it probably is heavy like what Tim Hudson threw, but I don't know that you'll see as many ground balls as Hudson got. It's really just more tail to the right side, to his arm side. So to me, that would be, you know, right there for number one in terms of the best or maybe even biggest moments of the weekend. I don't know how you ignore, though, this. Gosh, I think this might be number one.
There goes Julio. Here's the pitch. Swinging it. Swatted out to the gap. Right center field. Carrying back. Deep. Gone! Home run. Pinch hit. Two-run dinger by Jared Kelnick. And Kelnick is sprinting around the bases.
He then went and mobbed everybody. He was punching at him and practically tackled Julio Rodriguez. So that
he
could
looked like a wrestler.
Yeah.
Like celebrating, coming back to your teammates after you just pinned a rival. Like you run back to your coach.
Is that what you do? That's,
oh, yeah.
I'm sure you do.
After a big moment, you rip your headgear off and just sprint back to your coach.
Make sure you don't have cauliflower ear or something like that.
The first thing you do is you lightly jog over to the other coach, you shake a hand, you show some respect, and then you sprint back to your side. That's what it looked like.
Your Russian, what is it called?
Oh, my quiff.
Your Russian quiff. if Kelnick gets the confidence back, look out. If he can find that confidence, look out, because, you know, the celebration, that just everything he brings to the table, the easy power. He got on base a couple times here over the weekend. You can see maybe some signs that he's starting to pull out of this. If he does, I think that would be tremendous.
And after all the talk we've had of this last week of, you know, the question marks and could he be sent, and he goes out and hits that, you know he's thinking all that. He's heard all of it.
Of course.
It's a big celebration moment.
So put it all together. I mean, those are probably the top two. Ty France, none of it matters without the Ty France walk-off. You don't get there without Toro's home run. So I don't want to kind of sleep on either of those two moments. They were incredibly important. And then just, you know, it wasn't one moment, but Julio just continues to improve and impress. He's cut down the Ks. His numbers have been really good now for the last couple of weeks. And this one's from Jason Churchill. Julio over his last 15 games, which is more than half the season, hitting .309, on base .367, slugging .455. So you're talking about all-star level production here over the last 2 weeks. 146 WRC plus. Remember, league average is 100. So to be 46% over that is pretty impressive. And he's cut the strikeout rate down nearly to the major league average. So you're talking about a Julio Rodriguez that is starting to figure it out. You saw the triple over the weekend. The batted ball speed, just consistently impressive. Lots of good stuff, I think, ahead still for this team. And that's why I'm keeping the faith. I'm not giving up. And I think that we're all going to have a good summer. Okay, how's that? It may not start till forever.
And we're going to like it.
We're going to like it. It's going to be a lot of fun, I promise. Brady Henderson will join me coming up in 20 minutes after we tell you everything you need to know. Next, Mike Salk Show on Seattle Sports on 710, seattlesports.com.
Need to know.
15 minutes past every hour with Mike Salk.
Here's what you need to know up first.
Well, I know we get a lot of talk about the process, and certainly that's what we talk about, especially when things aren't going all that well. But sooner or later, you got to have results that go with it, right? Thankfully, Ty France ensured that was the case for the Mariners yesterday afternoon.
The pitch. Swing. Line drive. Sock left field. And this game is over. Kelnick scores. Ty France walk off base hit left field. And the Mariners take down the Rays, 2-1, the final score on this Mother's Day from Seattle.
Yeah, it was nice to see. Didn't Ty France's mom introduce him before the game, too, going through the starting lineup?
Yes,
Diane France.
Yep.
Batting second, Ty France. Nice job,
it's
Diane.
A good idea.
Yeah, and he ends up coming up with the big hit that they needed. 10th inning walk-off, completing a little comeback, snapping a 6-game losing skid that was honestly threatening to just derail this whole season. A great day at the ballpark yesterday. George Kirby making his major league debut with a personal cheering section and some really filthy stuff. His skipper, pretty impressed.
But I don't throw strikes. That's what George Kirby does. And the stuff was better than what we've seen at any point in spring training for me today. The life on the fastball. And get about 14, 15 swings and misses today. You know, didn't walk anybody.
Yeah, I think life on the fastball is a great way of describing it. It just exploded out of his hand, got on guys quickly, and with that arm side run, really difficult for them to catch up to it. 6 innings, shutout ball, 7 Ks, 4 hits, no walks, an unbelievable debut for the kid. They needed it, too. It was a heartbreaker on Friday, got away from him Saturday as well. But it looked like Kelnick had won them the game Friday night with a massive pinch hit home run in the eighth inning. And then Sewald blew his first save of the year right afterwards. They weren't able to get it done. And I've just felt like all the air was coming out of the balloon. So a big win for them yesterday. Back at it. Oh, that's my bad.
Here's the second thing you need to know.
That's my fault. I'll just tell you that Philly's in town for three starting tonight. All right, rookie minicamp. In the books, most of the draft picks, full participants, all of them able to at least contribute in some way. When asked who stood out, Pete Carroll, pretty definitive in his praise for his bookends on the offensive line.
I was so caught by the draft picks. You know, I thought everybody was able to show something, and the tackles jump out right off the bat. You know, both guys look well equipped physically. They look like they can move like we would hope they could move. They're both bright kids, and we'll pick up their stuff, so the process is underway. I was really fired up about that.
Yeah, Abe Lucas in particular really stood out, and I would be surprised, no, shocked, if both those guys aren't starting week one at tackle. Mentioned last week, KJ Wright would like to return to Seattle. Pete Carroll asked about that as well yesterday, and I don't know whether his answer made me believe that it's likely KJ Wright would be playing for this team.
I've already talked to him about stuff for the future and all that. I did hear that he talked about playing, and we've already talked about that.
Yeah, it's hard for me to see how he would fit here. Sounds like they've talked about playing. Doesn't mean they've talked about, like, a contract for him to come play here in a positive way. Pete talking about the future. I don't know. It's just hard to see how KJ fits. He doesn't rush the passer from the outside, which is sort of what they're looking for now out of the outside linebacker spot. And I just don't see him playing inside in this stage of his career. So if there's a way for him to contribute, I'm sure this team would be interested. Earl Thomas arrested. We'll talk to Brady Henderson about that for violating a restraining order, so I want to kind of dig into what's going on there. And then Richard Sherman, apparently, this according to Ian Rappaport a few minutes ago, deep in talks with Amazon for a key role in their programming this coming season, says he's still looking for a possible NFL opportunity, but as of now, his eyes are on his broadcasting future.
Here's the third thing you need to know.
Well, if you're like me, you generally know what you're doing first Saturday afternoon in May, watching the fastest three-year-olds in the land race around a dirt track in Kentucky, and, well, it did not disappoint. Rich Strike wasn't even supposed to be in this race, honestly, like Dante from Clerks, not even supposed to be here
today. I'm not even supposed to be here today!
Exactly, and yet he was. And he went out and won.
Epicenter and Zozo's in behind him. Cyberknife swings up on the outside. Sandin gets the rail run. And they're into the stretch. And it's Messier, Crown Pride. And Epicenter is coming up on the outside. Epicenter has taken the lead as they arrive into the final furlong. Sandin is coming after him. Epicenter and Sandin, these two, stride for stride. Simplification down the outside is next. They're coming down to the wire. Epicenter's ended. Rich Strike is coming up on the inside. Oh, my goodness. The longest shot has won the Kentucky Derby.
What an incredible call and a fantastic race. Really, really cool. 80-1 odds. Longest in the field. Just amazing. NBA. Two of the series that looked like they were going to be non-competitive all of a sudden are knotted at two. Dallas wins two in a row. They get back in it. Same with Philly, where James Harden finally showed up and led the Sixers to a win last night. Milwaukee up 2-1 over Boston. They're going to try to extend that tonight. Same with Golden State, which will play against a Memphis team that's missing Ja Morant. Obviously, the only way they could be beaten in this playoffs is if he is unable to go. NHL, four series, all got tied up at two yesterday. Wins by Boston, St. Louis, Tampa, and Los Angeles. Everything you need to know. We do that quarter past every hour.
Assuming you saw this over the weekend, but for those who didn't, the hand massage seen and felt and heard around the world.
Yeah.
From Madison Bumgarner.
Yes.
An official apology from the umpire.
I saw that. Yeah.
Not something I expected. An apology from an umpire.
He needed to.
Everybody in the world saw that creepy thing.
Don't you think?
Oof. He said, when I began my MLB career 15 years ago, I got good advice. I was told to umpire every game as if my children were sitting in the front row. I fell short of those expectations this week.
Yeah, no kidding.
I will learn from this incident, and I sincerely apologize.
Well, good to hear. It was obviously much, much needed after what we all saw.
Woof.
Yeah.
That's uncomfortable.
Yeah. You like that call, the Derby? Do you have any? Are there any Derby calls that, like, stand out to you over the years?
No.
I don't know.
I mean, like, when I hear them, I'm like, yeah, cool. I don't remember.
There's like two or three in my lifetime that for some reason the call stands out to me. Monarcos is one. I don't know if you remember Monarcos, like 2000. five, six, seven, somewhere in there. And there's just this great call where, like, Monarcos wasn't supposed to do anything, kind of like Rich Strike yesterday. And his call is, and here comes Monarcos! And it just, like, it really captures the moment really well. There's a great call for Funnyside as well. I don't know. You have to go back and see if you can find some of them. But horse racing is one of those things where I don't pay any attention.
Mind that bird.
Mind that bird.
That's the one that ever sticks out to me.
I remember that. That was
2009.
An upset surprise.
And the guy
well.
That won it, the jockey was Calvin Burrell.
Yeah.
And he won the very next year. And that was the guy that just became the everybody's got to have Calvin Burrell. Yeah.
The it guy for a jockey. So
I've got to remember that.
All right. We'll talk to Brady Henderson here coming up in just a moment. He spent the weekend at Seahawks rookie minicamp. We'll see what his observations were, who stood out, and what the future could be for some of these ex-Seahawks like K.J. Wright, Earl Thomas, and others. It's next. Mike Salk Show here on Seattle Sports on 710.
You're listening to the Mike Salk Show.
Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studio.
On Seattle Sports Station.
Well, some Pearl Jam for Brady Henderson here as this hour is driven by Wayscar Ford from one of your favorite movies, Brady, just for you. How about that?
You know what? As soon as I heard that guitar riff, I was thinking to the scene in Singles where it's actually kind of a sad scene where the female lead character walks into a bar and she sees the guy that she thought that she was dating.
Yeah.
And he's with another woman. So sad scene, great movie, and great Pearl Jam song. Thank you.
There you go. It was a pretty good weekend. I know you spent most of it deeply embedded inside Seahawks practice and watching all the rookies at minicamp. Who stood out to you?
Deeply embedded, yeah. Well, watching from the sidelines, deeply embedded, yeah. Same
Moore
thing.
And I got a little close yesterday. We were worried they were going to call us in accidentally. Like, all right, Salk, Dooley, get in there, play nose tackle. Like, we got a little too close to the sideline. We had to back it off.
Yeah, no, they would have put you right next to that 400-pound nose tackle that they have, and that would have been quite the visual. But, no, in terms of guys who stood out, you're going to like hearing this because from what I understand, you have unofficially claimed this Seahawks draft pick as your guy, but it was Boye Mafe. And, you know, I'll preface this by saying, like, they're not really playing football there. This was very much light work. The last day yesterday was basically a walkthrough. So they're just for the first 2 days, they were just in helmets and no shoulder pads. So really just sort of learning how to practice and learning the system and everything. But that said, you can still notice a few things about some guys. And, you know, the book on Boye Mafe when he was drafted was the explosion and the first step quickness and everything. And you can kind of see that. And, you know, when they're doing their team drills, I don't know what the hell these guys are supposed to be doing. So one of the things that I look for is, you know, when they come off the sideline, who looks like they're getting instruction versus who looks like they're getting congratulations from the coaches. And there were a few times where defensive coordinator Clint Hurt seemed very happy with what he was seeing from Boye Mafe. A lot of high fives and head slaps. And again, you can just see the explosion that, you know, I was looking at back at, you know, one of Todd McShay's old mock drafts before, I don't think it was his final one, but one of those in April, and he had Boye Mafe going in the first round. So this is a guy who was in the first round conversation. I think in large part due to just that explosion that you could kind of see off the bat.
The question with Mafe is going to be, how does he handle all the other parts of the job, right? Like, he's clearly got the physical skill set and he's a bright guy, obviously. I mean, to talk to him makes that very obvious. But, you know, where are the football instincts? And I think the only fear with him is that playing linebacker and all that comes with it is making sure that this isn't an Aaron Curry situation where, you know, the guy was built like a, you know, Greek god, but getting him to be in the right place at the right time, just instinctive football, it just never clicked for him.
Yeah. And you know, I don't know if there was like that consistent track record of production in college that you like to see. I mean, I think he had a good final season. One thing he's got going for him, you know, in addition to what you mentioned, the fact that he sounds like he has a very good head on his shoulders is, you know, this is not a huge transition for him, position wise, because that is sort of what he did in college, you know, standing up, I believe as a 3-4 outside linebacker. And so that's not going to be, completely foreign to him. And, you know, there's another interesting kind of sidebar to this is, I think I mentioned on our Twitter space chat the other day that, they had tried to trade up for a pass rusher late in the first round. And from what I have pieced together, I think that that was the guy from Penn State, whose first name is Arnold and whose last name I can't pronounce. And so then Atlanta ended up trading up over the Seahawks, ahead of the Seahawks in the second round to get him. And then the Seahawks took Mafe. So that's just a little side note. That's two careers that are going to be interesting to follow. But certainly I can't imagine the Seahawks were too disappointed in having Mafe there. Again, a guy who was some considered a first-round pick and a guy who seems like he's got a very bright future.
Hey, how long do you think it'll be before these corners can compete for some real playing time?
Not long. Well, I mean, I think with Tariq Woolen, probably a little longer because he is more of a project guy, a guy who has not been playing cornerback for very long. Now, this is different than, Trey Flowers. Remember, they drafted Trey Flowers in the fifth round in 2018. He had played safety throughout college, and they converted him to cornerback, and he won a starting job at a training camp right away. And by the way, that was under a defensive coordinator in Ken Norton Jr., who, as I've learned just through various conversations, even before they let him go, he was very reluctant to play younger players. And I think that this new regime, Clint Hurt and the other new defensive coaches there, they are going to embrace playing younger players a lot more than Ken Norton Jr. did. And so maybe Tariq Woolen seeing the field this season is not that far-fetched. But I think of the two corners, I think Kobe Bryant's got a lot better chance just because he's got a ton of experience. He was, I think, a five-year guy, ton of starting experience at Cincinnati, a ton of production. That is one of those spots, really both of those spots. I don't think as you're looking at it right now, you could say that either of the starting two cornerback spots are written in ink. And so I know they're excited about Trey Brown, but, he's coming off an injury. And Sidney Jones, they signed him to a very modest deal that certainly is not going to lock him into one of those starting spots. So I think Kobe Bryant's got a very good chance at starting this season. And they're keeping him on the left side for now, but he played both sides in college. So there's a good chance you see him in the starting lineup this season.
I'll tell you, you can't help but notice Woolen, though, while you're there. I mean, his physical attributes certainly jump off the page.
They do, yeah. And he was not he's kind of nursing a what sounds like a pretty mild hamstring injury, and so they weren't really doing anything with him. This is obviously not the time to push it with injuries, but he was there and standing around. And, Greg Bell and I were talking about this. Almost, he looks a lot like, just in terms of a physical profile, looks a lot like Trey Flowers, maybe even a little thicker than Trey Flowers was.
Yeah, it's like Trey Flowers mixed with some Brandon Browner in there.
I was just going to say that. And, even the same hairstyle as Trey Flowers, so you almost do like the double take. But, yeah, you're right, a little bit thicker. And I was looking at some of the, just the pre-draft projections. The NFL.com does these cool little bios on players, and you can kind of see where they had guys projected going before the draft. And again, this doesn't always matter, because what's to say that the draft analysts are right, but the projection on him was second to third round, and the Seahawks, of course, got him in the fifth round. So again, we got to see what he becomes, but he's got the physical tools, and that could end up being a nice steal for them.
The guy that jumped out to me, oddly, I know you put me as Boye Mafe, as his guy, and I am excited about Boye Mafe, but just being there and looking at everyone, Abe Lucas, I thought, was the most physically impressive dude that I saw there. He just looks like he came out of central casting as a right tackle.
yeah, he does. And it's interesting, you can kind of look at him and you look at Charles Cross, and you see the way Charles Cross moves. And again, we're not looking at these guys playing football. And especially the offensive linemen, it was hard for me to kind of get a good read on them, because a lot of times they're practicing opposite of where we're standing. And so, but you do see these guys just in the stretch line, and you see them in the agility line, and you just, like, Charles Cross looks like a left tackle, and he looks like a first round pick, just with the way he looks and the way he moves and the build. And then you're right, Abe Lucas just looks like a guy who likes to maul people. And, John Steiner had what I thought was a pretty funny quote during the draft. We're talking about how he's a deep man of faith, and you can see it. We were talking to him, and he's got, I think, depictions of Christ tattooed on both of his arms. And he sounds like, a pretty mild mannered guy, but apparently when he gets going and he's on the field, he's a finisher, and he's a pretty physical player. And so that's exactly what you're looking for at right tackle.
Yeah, seeing Charles Cross, it was sort of like seeing Russell Okung out there, but not dragging his injured ankle around with him.
That's a joke that, you know, that was so long ago, Mike, that I think you might have to explain that.
Sorry. It just, Russell Kung always felt like he was limping around with his ankle, like, two, 3 feet behind him. I don't know. He always seemed to be playing injured, trying to, you know, not be injured, et cetera. Is it really that long ago? All right, let's move on. We don't need any of that. Let's talk more about Nick Paul, Brady. I'm obsessed. Pete sounds like he's obsessed. How big is that dude?
Well, he's bigger than what he is listed on the roster, which I think is I can't remember the height, but I think it was 385.
He's
pounds.
Listed as 6'7", 385.
6'7", 385, and I think Pete Carroll said that he's only listed as 385 because that's as high as their, like, their scales don't go any higher than 385. Pete Carroll, he referenced him being four bills plus, so, which I believe it, just by, I mean, so you could see him standing next to, like, an average-sized lineman, right? And, like, I would say the difference, like, if I were to stand next to, a 6'2", 320-pound guy, you know, the difference between me and him is the same as the difference between an average-sized lineman and this guy. That's how big this guy is. And, anytime you're making, like, a 6'2", 325-pound guy look small by comparison, then you're a large man. Pete Carroll said it was the biggest human he's ever seen outside of David Baker, the guy who used to run the Hall of Fame, who was apparently a giant.
Yeah, pretty cool. I don't know if it'll work out. And, you know, two-gap system, though, right? If you can put him at nose tackle, sometimes there's room for these just gigantic humans who can kind of figure it out and just sort of stand in one place and occupy blockers. So kind of curious to see if he's a practice squad guy who has some long-term future. Talking to Brady Henderson, our friend from ESPN.com, about the Seahawks this weekend. Pete asked about KJ Wright. Listening to his answer, it sure didn't sound like a reunion was likely on the field, but I wonder if there's some way for these two sides to get together.
Yeah, that was my interpretation of it too. And you know, Pete Carroll has a way of making things pretty clear without actually spelling them out. And I thought that that's what he did with the KJ Wright comment. And this, you know, stems to KJ Wright telling Trey Wingo a few days ago that he wants to, quote unquote, come back home and he wants to play for the Seahawks. And Carroll was asked about that yesterday. And like you said, nothing in his response made it sound at all like they're interested in having him come play for them. But there was one of Carroll's comments didn't make it sound like they've discussed a return in a non-playing capacity, I don't know what exactly that would mean. Presumably that
coaching
would
coaching intern or something like that.
Yes. Yeah. Some sort of coaching role. The fact that, I don't know, KJ Wright still sounds like he wants to play. Maybe he's not ready for that, but you know, he also made an interesting comment to Trey Wingo where he was talking about how he's not going to, you know, leave his family and move them across the country. And so maybe if the right playing opportunity doesn't come about, maybe that does come into play. But, I think we and fans and observers tend to just, you always want to see these guys like move into coaching roles. And look, coaching is not for everybody. And so that is a massive, massive grind on those guys. And it's really not for everybody, but so we'll see if there's any interest in KJ Wright doing it. But that was my interpretation of what Carroll was saying.
Do you think there's any relevance to the fact that KJ, who is Bobby Wagner's best friend, is willing to come back here so soon after the, you know, issues between Bobby and the team with the way he was let go?
What do you mean?
I just think for as much as that story about Bobby and the team has been built up, I just find it interesting that, what, a month or two later, his best friend is like, yeah, I want to go back to Seattle.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, and I think that you have seen that with a lot of the guys who have kind of left difficult circumstances, you know. A lot of those guys end up wanting to come back and join the Seahawks. And I don't think with KJ Wright, I think that was a lot different than Earl Thomas and Richard Sherman. I think that was just a simple case of, you know, they wanted to move on. I don't think the bridge at the time seemed as burned, or if that was as difficult of a divorce. But at any rate, a lot of those guys, from everything I've heard, you know, they go away and they go to other places, and maybe they realize that Seattle's a pretty good situation, you know, a first-class organization. And that's just what I've heard, that a lot of those guys, Richard Sherman was one of them, they end up wanting to come back, and maybe Michael Bennett as well.
Marshawn. I mean, like, they can't keep Marshawn out of the building these days.
Yeah. And maybe he's another one that, you know, he was sound like he was ready to go when he left. And he obviously wanted to come back. And so I think it kind of speaks to, you know, what the Seahawks have built. And it's a organization and a team that guys want to play for. And maybe they realize that when they go somewhere else.
Did you follow any of the Earl Thomas news here over the last week?
Yeah.
So what's going on there?
So there was a warrant issued for his arrest in Travis County, Texas, which is where Austin is. Of course, he played at Texas. I believe he has a home in the Austin area. And he was alleged to have violated a court protective order, which stipulated that he was not allowed to contact his wife, who he is. I believe there's an ongoing divorce there. He was not allowed to contact her outside of a co-parenting phone app. And he was, I think, texting her directly and allegedly, according to the woman, told police that there were some threatening messages there. And so there was a warrant issued for his arrest as of yesterday afternoon when I called the Travis County Jail. He had not turned himself in yet.
Okay. Well, it was like right after he said he wanted to make a comeback and he was ready to play again. And, kind of, you know, I worry about Earl Thomas, kind of just worry about, you know, where his future goes. Of all the guys that have left here, it seems like getting away from football will be very challenging for him.
Yeah, and I know there's people in the Seahawks building who are also very concerned about him just because there has been, you know, a troubling pattern of behavior. There was the incident a couple years ago where, you know, his wife pulled a loaded handgun and pointed it at his head when she, you know, confronted him at a hotel believing that he was having an affair. I think in the Austin newspaper that broke the story about the arrest warrant also noted that he was arrested for illegally carrying a handgun himself after that. There's just been a very troubling pattern of behavior, and that's, you know, there was also the issue that the punching a teammate at practice, which got him booted from the Ravens 1 year after signing a massive deal. So there's it doesn't sound good.
Brady, it was fun. It was a fun weekend. It was nice to see these guys out there. And again, an exciting rookie class for the Seahawks. So cool to be out there. And now we'll see these guys in action with mini camp here in a couple of weeks and then training camp, of course, in August. So thanks, man. We appreciate it.
Yeah, you bet, Mike. Anytime.
All right, there you go. There's Brady Henderson, our buddy from ESPN.com. Of course, used to work here in our building for a long, long time. And good friend of mine, friend of the show, et cetera. And Brady does a great job covering the team. Honestly, always has, I think, a really good sense of kind of the pulse of what's going on there. And, you know, it's funny, more from where we were sitting and standing, standing yesterday and watching, I don't know that we could tell as much about Boye Mafe. He was like on the far side of the far corner from us. So I think that's really encouraging to hear that was Brady's big takeaway, is that Boye Mafe, second round pick, number 40 overall, a guy that they're really counting on to come in, especially in specific pass rush situations, to get to the quarterback, which is something they've really struggled to do for the last few years. I think that's great to hear that he would be one of your top standouts.
Yeah, especially because he's coming in with not a ton of experience. You know, like we talked about, he really stood out at the Combine and the Senior Bowl, and he had a good last season. But other than that, there's not a huge body of work. So we thought, you know, he might need a little more time to develop. So the fact that he's impressing right off the bat is really good news.
Yeah, and a guy that sounds like specifically reacts well to good coaching. And so if you're hearing that there's getting the encouragement and learning about the techniques, et cetera, it sounds like that's the key to him, is really developing him as a player. And if they can do it, they may have an absolute star on their hands. So
now he's got a defensive coordinator that specializes in his position. So that's a great fit.
All of it. It sounds like it's a good road ahead here for Boye Mafe. So I thought that was pretty cool. I got a texter here saying, Salk, you're making something out of nothing with the Wagner exit. Actually, the other way around. What I'm suggesting is that a lot of other people made something that probably was nothing. And the fact that KJ Wright is so interested in coming back so soon after the supposed incident shows that maybe it's not as big a deal as maybe people are making it out to be.
I disagree with you. I don't think people made it a big deal. I think Bobby made it very clear that he was upset.
Yeah.
And I think that he even said, like, in the future, he thinks that they might be able to get past it. But right now, he went, how many interviews did he do where he kept saying the same thing over and over again?
Clearly, he's not happy. I think what I'm saying is the reaction that's the only side to the story is where I think there's not grounded in reality.
I don't think that's how these guys roll. I don't think that he would ever I don't think KJ would be so mad about that. Something that Bobby himself said in the future they'll probably move on from, that he'd be like, I'm never going back to Seattle.
Then maybe the story shouldn't have been made quite as big a deal as I think people made it out to be. So I don't think the Seahawks did anybody dirty. I think that, you know, I understand why Bobby was upset, but I think that they've handled these things pretty darn well in incredibly awkward situations over the years, and guys that really love being here. So yeah, I think it's relevant anyway that KJ was willing, and not just willing, basically saying here or nowhere. Like, either I come back to Seattle or I go nowhere. And it does make you wonder why it's kind of been like that for this program in particular, where guys get real mad when they leave and then really miss it here and seem to come back eventually and kind of rejoin the program. What is it about, like, I kind of get it with New England and Belichick and sort of the way they're treated like chattel, where they're just like, okay, I guess I meant nothing to anybody ever, but they kind of knew that all the way along. I think just sort of the icy cold way in which everything is done there kind of makes people either accept it or get mad about it, and you can kind of understand it. And I wonder if it's that the opposite is so true here in Seattle that it makes it hard for guys when they leave, because they're so loved, they're so beloved by the coaching staff, they're such, you know, there's such a personal interest in their lives and taking care of them, not only on the field but off of it, and it's a really great place to be, that when your time runs out and it is time for them to make a hard decision and move on from guys that have been incredibly productive here in the system, it's got to feel like it's out of left field, right? What do you mean you're moving on from me, but you love me?
Well, didn't we hear this from, what, more? Was it Cassius Marsh? Then when he left, didn't he go to the Patriots?
He went to the Patriots.
Hey, it's not very fun over here.
Right. He said it was soulless and terrible, and he did not enjoy it at all. And he ended up coming back here at some point anyway. He's yet another person to have come back here. I think there might be something to how well they're treated here that leads to a sense of shock when they're no longer necessary or no longer going to be wanted, and then B, a desire to come back not that long after you go somewhere else and realize just how much better it was here. And that gives me some hope too, that as the Seahawks try to turn this thing back around, whether you're calling it a rebuild or a reimagination or a restocking or a renovation of the roster, whatever it is, that they should be able to do it sooner and quicker rather than later because of some of that reputation that I think they instill. And that's why I think the Bobby thing jumped out so much, because it really felt like an attack on that image that they have, that I think they've worked pretty hard to avoid.
Yeah, I can hear that. I also can hear what Morris saying too, where it maybe isn't. And do we know for sure, like, this is me asking as maybe not someone that followed it as closely, Bobby and KJ were best friends.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah, no, they're really, really tight and have been, like, for, and like all those guys are
you
pretty tight.
Assume that too from a position group standpoint, but.
No, I think that's been pretty well documented, that those guys are really close, really tight, and just loved playing with each other for as long as they did. So good stuff from Brady, and a really, really fun weekend. Nice to see this rookie class. I don't know if it's going to lead to immediate success for the Seahawks. I was talking to some people this weekend asking me what to expect. And, you know, until you get that quarterback situation truly figured out, I don't know what to expect out of this team in 2022, but I think the future looks brighter and brighter because of the core that they're building, and seeing those tackles really shine right off the bat. I don't know that you could get better news out of the first couple of days of Seahawks rookie minicamp other than that the tackles looked the part, acted the part, and were right on top of things. So pretty cool. Good weekend for the Seahawks. All right, coming up, I want to get back into this Mariner weekend, which looked like it was going to be an unbelievable, epic disaster. And I wonder how some different groups of fans are taking it. We'll kind of figure it out together next. Mike Salk Show here on Seattle Sports on 710 and seattlesports.com.